The following message is brought to you by Terry Moore. And now, Mr. Moore.
Let's go ahead and open up to Matthew 10. And the reading today, given by Mr. Schock, Christ had said in Matthew 5 and verse 9, "Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the sons or the children of God." Now, peace is something that is desired by nearly all people, no matter race or creed. We would all like to have peace in the workplace. We would like to have peace in our schools, peace in the family, in the community, peace nationally, peace in the world. But can this be achieved at this time? What does it mean, actually, for Christ, when Christ said to be a peacemaker? Is Christ telling us that we need to try to solve the world's problems, the national problems, our community's problems, and bring peace to the nation right now? Is Christ relating that we should, well, just go along to get along so that there will be peace in the family, at work, or even in the church of God? Is he saying that, well, we need to try to remove ourselves from all conflict so that there will be a form of peace? Well, I think surprisingly we're going to learn today that he's not saying any of these things at all. Because there are many definitions of peace, and some of the most commonly understood definitions in modern language are a non-warring condition of a nation, group of nations, or the world. Something that I think everyone would like to see. There is a state of mutual harmony between people or groups that is considered to be peace, or a form of peace. An absence of hostility, or an absence of violence within a community. I think that would be relative peace. And of course, there's the definition of being of one accord, or harmony between two or more individuals, whether in a relationship or in a casual acquaintance. And this, of course, would include a cessation of strife or dissension. Well, I don't know about you, but in my life, cessations of strife don't seem to last very long. And I'm not talking about you, Michelle. We have a pretty good relationship when it comes to that. But, being in the ministry, I think, might make my situation slightly different than many others. But I think we all have times of strife in our lives, times of disagreement, times of conflict. And therefore, I think all of us face a lack of peace in our lives. So how can we get to a point where Christ would consider us a peacemaker, an individual who will be called the child or son of God? What does it mean to make peace in this way, and how do we go about doing it? Well, I hope to give us some of the answers anyway in this message today. And it must first be understood that a peacemaker does not mean that there is an end to strife in our lives. You know, not that we are the start or the author of contention, but consider that peacemakers, Christ said, will be called the children of God. And Christ, we know, is currently the only begotten child or son of God. And he said in Matthew 10, in verse 34, he said, "Do not think that I came to bring peace on the earth. I did not come to bring peace, but a sword." So how does this play into him saying, "Blessed are those who are the peacemakers"? Well, of course, Christ in this statement in Matthew 10:34, he was speaking of that time of his ministry until his return. And as a result of his teaching, which, his teaching was contrary to most of the traditions of the Jews, and his teachings continue to be contrary to most of the teachings of the various sects of Christianity today, or professing Christianity. So I think what he's relating is there would be no peace until he steps down on the Mount of Olives and lays down the law for his millennial reign on the earth. So in this way, one could actually argue that, well, Christ seems to be the source of contention for many people. That, you know, we see that he wasn't afraid to call a hypocrite, a spade, in other words, in certain situations. But he also, we see that he held his tongue at times, understanding that there was a time to speak and also a time to keep silent. Even when being confronted by Pilate, he wouldn't speak on his in his own defense. So we see also that Christ, he turned over the tables of the money changers in the temple. He railed on those individuals for defiling God's house, as it was referred to, you know, bringing in corruption and greed. But he left the tables of the tax collectors' booths alone. And, you know, he told the people to give money to Caesar. Give their hard-earned money to Caesar. We see that he called the leaders of the Jews blind leaders of the blind. And he even said that their father was the devil, a liar, a murderer from the beginning. But we also see then he set a woman that was caught in adultery free. Said he wasn't going to condemn her at that time. So we see that Christ, he actually knew the perfect balance of word and action to continue to live up to the name Prince of Peace and be a peacemaker. But we see that there was not a cessation of strife in his life. And I think this helps us to see the kind of peace that you and I are to seek and are to try and make. Because, you know, we can have a relative amount of peace in our lives with our family, with our co-workers, with our neighbors, with brethren that are in the church and the various splinter groups. Therefore, we see a peace is not necessarily the absence of conflict, but a peacemaker has the ability to cope with the conflict. So a peacemaker, it, being a peacemaker means that we need to learn when to point the finger and when the finger needs to be pointed back at us and when we should just simply put our hands down and not judge the situation at that time at all. Being a peacemaker takes integrity, complete honesty. It takes humility and it takes a sense of calm. So a peacemaker, I think, can be one to suggest resolutions, to open up the conversation to the truth, and of course to align everything that we do with God's law. And we should, therefore, try to have a sense of relative peace in our community, in our neighborhood even, in our city, state, or in our nation. But this does not mean, don't get me wrong, and I think you understand this already, but it does not mean that we need to bury our moral values and we need to just go along with everything just to get along. On the contrary, we see that a peacemaker, as defined by Christ, will always uphold the law, whether by word or by example, and always by example. In fact, it could be argued that example is the most important of these. It was Thomas Carlyle who said that one example is worth 1,000 arguments. I think it goes along with the saying, you know, actions are louder than words. Now consider, if you will, the context of Christ's statement in Matthew 10:34, that he did not come to bring peace. And let's read through a few verses here. In verse 34 again, do not think that I came to bring peace on the earth. I did not come to bring peace, but a sword. For I have come to set a man against his father, a daughter against her mother, a daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law. And a man's enemies will be those of his own household. In other words, it's going to get intimate. You know, he who loves father, and then he goes on to say, and this helps us to understand, he who loves father or mother more than me is not worthy of me. And he who loves son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. In other words, God is our priority in life. And he who does not take up his cross and follow after me is not worthy of me. Because he who finds his life or tries to find his life, build his life in this world will lose it. But he who loses his life or is willing to give up those things that they might desire in this life for righteousness' sake, they will find it. They will find eternal life is what he is referring to. So I think this helps us to understand the kind of sword that Christ brought. It was not a long blade carried in a sheath and strapped to our side. Of course, this doesn't mean that Christ was opposed to owning a sword. We see that even one of the disciples, at least in his midst, owned a sword. But the sword that Christ spoke of, that he brought or carried, is that of his tongue. It is his mouth, that which he spoke, being like a described in the book of Revelation, like a sharp two-edged sword that we use as to strike to the heart of the matter, to strike within the emotions of individuals. And this can be offensive to many people. It can, because we realize we're wrong and we need to be corrected. But we see that the sword that Christ carried could also be used as a defense against the fiery darts of the wicked one. And we saw that played out in last week's reading when he was confronted by Satan, using the word of God as an offense as well as a defense. But Christ said that he came to set family members against one another. And what this means is to divide. Not that he wants to destroy the family, but he is talking about separating the sheep from the goats. Those people who want to follow God and desire to do his will, as opposed to those who might not. And even if it's a relative, a close relative, somebody you love dearly, you're going to be in opposition to one another if one seeks the way of God and the other does not. And so the alienation would only occur when there's a disbelief in this regard. And, Christ did not call many of the Jews hypocrites because they were too conservative about the law. And we saw that read in Matthew 5 today. And this is sort of an aside, but it is definitely related, because there are those who have labeled individuals who refuse to dine out on the Sabbath or to do business on the Sabbath in this way. I have heard even ministers in the church point and refer to those people as Pharisees, even during in the midst of a gathering of believers, saying, look, there goes a Pharisee. But God would never ridicule anybody for strictly keeping God's law. And what it is they are misusing terms, misunderstanding actually what it means to be a Pharisee, because a Pharisee is an individual who keeps their tradition as opposed to keeping God's law, not keeping a tradition that's in line with God's law. And so, what is dining out on the Sabbath? It's a tradition. It's something that people enjoy to do, an activity. In fact, it's very much a worldly pursuit, going out into the world and having people cook your food and bring you your food and clean up your mess afterward and then paying them for their services. And that is, in fact, what the Pharisees practiced, their traditions, their activities that were outside of God's law, actually. And Christ had later said, why do you transgress the commandment of God because of your tradition in Matthew 15? And he also said, you have made the commandment of God of no effect because of your tradition. So they were keeping that instead of keeping this God's law and not even, recognizing what the law required of them. And so the point is, the context of Christ's statement of bringing a sword is not saying that Christ is not a peacemaker. The context is talking about conflicts with those individuals who oppose the commandments of God. And so if your own family is going to oppose the direction that we might take in life into choosing to obey God's law, then there is going to be strife. It's inevitable. But we can get through it. We can. And so we see the sword is, I think, metaphorically speaking, a sword fight, if you will, of words. Let's go to Romans 12. Romans 12. Nevertheless, when exchanges of words take place, we see that our fight, it really isn't with the person. We don't try to hurt people or harm them because they may have hurt us. This is where the concept of loving others, even loving your enemies, comes from. Because what we do in these disagreements, these situations that can be labeled or categorized as strife, what we do is to respectfully state the facts, to speak the truth. And this is should be done with a sincere desire for people to understand. But realizing, of course, that you know we are not always right either. There might be something that we need to learn in this situation. And so love your neighbor, love your family, love your enemies. But this does not mean that we love them all in the same way, but we treat them with the same mindset. That is, we treat them with a mutual respect. We don't intentionally try to hurt them, but we will make suggestions, comments, or discussions will be based on what is best for them as well, even if they don't realize it. Understanding what God truly does expect from us and what really creates an environment for peace in this world. Romans 12, and we're going to read several verses here, beginning in verse 9, regarding this application of love. It says, "Let love be without hypocrisy. Abhor what is evil, cling to what is good. Be kindly affectionate to one another with brotherly love, in honor, that is, with respect, giving preference to one another." In other words, deferring to the other person's needs, even when it might mean that we don't get what we want, you know, treating them better than us, or at least better than the way that they might treat us. Verse 11, "Not lagging in diligence, fervent in spirit, serving the Lord." In other words, our service to others is to be a reflection of the service that we provide to God. "Rejoicing in hope, patient in tribulation, continuing steadfastly in prayer." And here we get to the sense of peace or contentment in the situation, being patient, or having a peace of mind, in other words. "Distributing to the needs of the saints, given to hospitality, bless those who persecute you, bless and do not curse, rejoice with those who rejoice, and weep with those who weep," meaning having, you know, a sense of sympathizing with individuals, of what they might be experiencing. And then he goes on to say, "Be of the same mind," speaking of brethren, "being of the same mind toward one another, do not set your mind on high things," meaning not being proud or arrogant, "but associate with the humble." And the King James translation says, "Condescend to men of low estate," meaning be like those individuals, those great men and women of faith that have humility. That was mentioned in the reading today, people like Moses. "Do not be wise in your own opinion," or in other words, "do not be conceited. Repay no one for evil," and I'll read this, but it's not in the, I don't think this is the right translation. It says, "Have regard for good things in the sight of old men," and I think the correct translation is "provide things honest in the sight of old men," and it's just a matter of having integrity. And then it says, If it is possible, as much as depends on you, live peaceably with all men." Not just men, women, children, you know. So live peaceably with all individuals, if possible. And I think this relates that it's not always going to be possible to live peaceably with everyone in life, because we see that a peacemaker's life is going to have its share of friction, of contention, of strife. Sometimes we must stand up and disagree. Sometimes we see that we need to bite our tongue and move on, seeing that this is a fight that is not ours at this time. Sometimes we need to simply live with a disappointment. Perhaps the relationship cannot be entirely healed at this time, but we shouldn't let it bring us down. Christ said, he indicated that there are going to be rough roads. There are going to be stormy seas if you choose to follow him, And he expressed this by saying, who doesn't ever take up his cross? A form of persecution. Give up your life for me, that they cannot be his disciple. So there is going to be trouble in our life. There's going to be argument at times. There will even eventually be persecution. And we saw that read in the reading today. Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake. And Luke also had quoted Christ as saying, blessed are you when men hate you, they exclude you and revile you and cast out your name as evil for the Son of Man's sake. He says to rejoice in this. Not that it really makes us happy, but have the contentment, the assurance that indeed your reward is going to be great in heaven. So we are going to be hurt by other people at times, even when we try to do them good, and still we need to learn to say, forgive them, God. They don't really know what they're doing. Most of the time, I would say 99% of the time, people that might do us harm, cause us hurt, don't really understand what they are doing. However, the efforts that we make to live peaceably with them, whenever possible, if at all possible, is going to pay off later on in life. You know, it was Norman Schwarzkopf who said this. He said, the more you sweat in peacetime, the less you bleed during war. And I think this is a good example, or a good expression at least, to understand that it takes a lot of work. Having peace and having a peace of mind and being a peacemaker is not easy. But we have to seek it. We have to seek it externally, that is within our environment with other individuals, and we have to work at it internally. And this is perhaps one of the most important aspects of being a peacemaker. And again, we sometimes refer to it as having a peace of mind. So along with being able to deal with contention, we have to learn to have contentment. But how do we do this? How can we be content in this world and in our lives when sometimes it seems like everything is being turned upside down? Well, the first way is to live honorably. This can be expressed as having integrity or being faithful. They all fall into the same category. And I think this will, if we do this, this will help us to have a peace of mind, knowing that we are doing what is required of us, our reasonable service to God. You know, we see that we can't always go along to get along, but we can actually keep ourselves from the misbehavior or the sins of others, and we can actually coexist in the neighborhood. We can go to the workplace and work there and not participate in their sins. And that's actually what we have to do. You know, we have no choice, actually, in this life. Christ said that we are not of the world. His disciples are not of the world. But yet, he said we have to be in the world and not of it. And so this is also mentioned in the book of Revelation, where he tells his church to come out of her, come out of the ways of this world, be separate and do not partake of this world's sins. But with a need to coexist in this environment, it doesn't come without warning. And perhaps some of this is based upon the individual, because we are all individuals in many ways, living by the same laws, but we all have various strengths and weaknesses. But the point is I don't want everyone to think that, well, it's okay for us to continually put ourselves in an environment where there is a lot of sin taking place and it's not going to affect us. Maybe we're strong in that way and we can allow ourselves to be in a situation over and over again where we are not going to allow that to influence us. But don't think that that can be the case all the time. And there's a couple of examples, firsthand examples, is, you know, there have been several people that have attended with us in the past where they wholeheartedly believe many of the doctrines that the Eternal Church of God teaches. And there was a particular time when there was a disagreement that came up on a particular doctrine. And they did not want to agree, and it got to the point, got so heated to where they had left They had become independent and stayed on their own for a period of time. And then as time moved on, well, they began to discount other things that they wholeheartedly believed, that they proved. But now, because of the contention, it allowed them to move themselves further away from the truth, from something that they knew was wrong. And I think, well, those sins are not so bad anymore. In fact, there was one individual that fully believed in not dining out on the Sabbath, had proven it, had attended with us for some time, and then because we did not live in the same area, there was a need or a desire to have fellowship, which we should encourage. We want people to have fellowship. And some people can go to the various churches of God and attend and not be influenced by some of the wrong teaching out there. But this particular individual, over a period of time, began to think, well, dining out at restaurants isn't really such a big deal. It's not that big of a sin. When it violates the fourth commandment, he had understood this before, but now it's not that big a deal. And then other things began to creep in, some of the false doctrine that was being taught by a particular organization. But 2 Timothy 2, the point is, I don't want people to think that, you know, we can tolerate something that is wrong for a period of time and it's going to be okay. You know, maybe we can, but maybe we can't, because sometimes individuals might begin to minimize the sin to a point where we think, well, it's not that bad. It's not that big of a deal. Maybe God doesn't really care about that very much, and then allow themselves to participate in a behavior that is clearly wrong. And this could be detrimental to us. It was Helen Keller who said, she said, "I do not want the peace which passes understanding. I want the understanding which brings peace." And I think that's very well said. And I think it expresses a kind of humility that God's people should have when we are striving to be a peacemaker. And this is something else that is essential. Having integrity, Proverbs 3, verse 7, you don't have to turn there, but it says, "Do not be wise in your own eyes, but revere or fear the eternal and depart from evil." And this is something else that was mentioned in the reading today, to be meek or humble. And it's a necessity in being a peacemaker, because, you know, we don't want to minimize sin because of the pride of life. Because that's what pride of life does. It begins to think, well, my sins are not that bad, or you know, certain sins are not so bad, so I should focus on the bigger ones and not worry about these little ones. But it's all sin. It all needs to be dealt with in various ways. We can't think one is worse than the other and not work on one without the other. It's a God's looking at the big picture of our lives, the whole person. And that is what we are to try to do ourselves, look at the big picture of our lives and every part of our behavior. And for this reason, we know God resists the proud, and Paul was inspired to write this in 2 Timothy 2. And verse 22, he said, "To flee youthful lusts, but pursue righteousness, pursue faith, love, peace with those who call on the Lord out of a pure heart. But avoid foolish and ignorant disputes, knowing that they generate strife. And a servant of the Lord must not quarrel, but be gentle to all, able to teach, patient, in humility, correcting those who are in opposition." You see, so it's not a cessation of strife. We need to speak up at times. "If God perhaps will grant them repentance so that they may know the real truth, and they may come to their senses and escape the snare of the devil." And so when it comes to argument that has a potential for injury, and perhaps all argument may have a potential for injury, there is a way to respectfully bring up a matter of contention without turning it into a petulant quarrel. And Paul said it here when he said to avoid ignorant disputes. So sometimes it's not worth the fight, the effort. Sometimes it's a losing battle, and why do we need to participate in such arguments? You know, I would put it in the category of Christ saying, "Don't cast your pearls before swine." You're not going to convince some people don't feel like you need to go around correcting everybody, every single wrong thing that we see. There's a time to speak and a time to keep silent. And he said it, I think, also saying that we are to be, this is to be done in humility, not with a sense of pride of like, well, I know better than you. You need to listen to me. What I have to say is important. Well, maybe it is, maybe it isn't. But no, people are not going to, they start shutting you down. You have that kind of attitude. You start coming off to other individuals that like, I'm better than you. Immediately, what we are saying begins to be rejected. And so it needs to be done with meekness. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. And then, of course, there is, when it comes to brethren, there is the Matthew 18. There is a way to resolve conflict or offense within the church of God. And it almost always works to go to the brother first, to speak to them alone, and to do so peaceably, to try to keep the relationship, because that's what we want. Don't we? We want the relationship. We want to keep that intact. We want to remove the block and to keep that, you know, that bond going, that friendship. If that doesn't work, then we bring to a witness or two, and you know, somebody that is familiar with the situation that can help to resolve the conflict. And then, of course, if that doesn't work and it needs to escalate, to take it before the church leadership, well, both parties have to agree to the decision that's made. James in chapter 4, I was a part of a conflict resolution recently at the community garden that I volunteer at, where there was a couple of gardeners there that had some issues with each other and had an exchange of words. And, well, we were hearing one side of the story. I just couldn't help but note the person explaining their side is, it was, you know, people are usually like this, but it's all about them. You know, I feel, I think, I believe, you made me feel like, and it's all about feelings and emotion, and there's always going to be an aspect of that in any kind of a conflict that we might have or offense. But sometimes we need to take how we feel, we need to kind of remove some of that out of the situation so we could look at, well, despite how we feel, what are the facts? You know, what was actually said? I know how it made you feel, but what was actually said? You know, and that can really help us to have a good perspective of the argument or the situation. So despite the fact that we're all trying to do our best and we would all like to work together in peace, we see that there is going to be offense at times, and sometimes it's going to work out. Hopefully, most of the time it will work out. That's what we work for, try for. Sometimes it won't. But we're going to face discord outside of the church. We're going to face it. Occasionally, we're going to see it within the church. So I think it's important for us to recognize where most conflict comes from. The origin of conflict. James in chapter 4 and verse 1, he said, "Where do wars and fights come from among you? Do they not come from your desires for pleasure that war in your members?" And then he goes on to say, "You lust and do not have, you murder and covet," not literally, but, you know, destroying other individuals, hurting other people, coveting what they have. "You cannot obtain, you fight, you war, yet you do not have because you do not ask. You ask and do not receive because you ask amiss, that you might spend it on your pleasures. Adulterers and adulteresses, do you not know that friendship with the world is enmity with God? And whoever therefore wants to be a friend of the world makes himself an enemy of God," or in opposition to God. "Do you think that the scriptures say in vain, the spirit that dwells in us yearns jealously?" And so this, I think, is of this last verse here, which is an important one. There's a bit of a mistranslation in here. And the spirit that dwells in us lusts to envy actually is referring to the spirit of man. And envy is being pithnos, which is something that is referring to a type of ill will towards other individuals. But the point is, if you go to Jeremiah chapter 6, the wars, the disputes, the conflicts of men are the result of a desire to have what somebody else has. You know, a desire to take what the other nation enjoys, to desire to take what the other city or community or the family or the person has so that we can have. And this is coveting. It's the 10th commandment. And this is the reason there's no peace in the world. You know, the 10th commandment is not the last commandment because it's the least important. Certainly not. This is actually the root of all evil. Jeremiah 6 and verse 11, I think God said this very well through the prophet Jeremiah, referring to the sins of Israel, the sins of Judah here. Jeremiah sent to the house of Judah. God was basically furious about what these people were doing. And in verse 11, Jeremiah 6 and verse 11, "Therefore I am full of the fury of the Eternal. I am weary of holding it in. I will pour it out on the children outside and on the assembly of young men together. For even the husband shall be taken with the wife, the aged with him who is full of days, and their houses shall be turned over to others, fields and wives together. For I will stretch out my hand against the inhabitants of the land." That is how bad it had become. And we heard about this in the reading, the Bible study last night in the book of Amos. And he, continuing, says the Lord, here's the reason. "Because from the least of them, even to the greatest of them, everyone is given to covetousness. And from the prophet even to the priest, everyone deals falsely with each other. And they have also healed the hurt of my people slightly, just a little bit, saying, 'Peace, peace.' But there is no peace." No, there can be no peace in an environment such as this. In coveting, we see it's a selfish attribute, isn't it? That's what caused Lucifer to fall. Coveting God's position. Coveting the future that God was going to set for the people that he would create. And this caused discord. And therefore, the way of peace we see is opposite to coveting. It's opposite to selfishness. It is a selfless, therefore, attitude. A selfless way of life. You know, behaving and interacting with others that stem from a loving concern for them. And this is the way of a peacemaker. And this is explained in 1 Corinthians 13. 1 Corinthians 13, this is explained in Paul's beautiful definition of love. And I'm just going to read verses 4 through 7, 1 Corinthians 13 and verse 4, where he said, "Love suffers long and is kind. Love does not envy. Love does not parade itself. It's not arrogant or boastful. It's not puffed up or proud. Does not behave rudely, does not seek its own, is not provoked and thinks no evil, does not rejoice in iniquity." It doesn't rejoice when other people get theirs. "Oh, I'm glad they got theirs. They deserve it." No, that's not the way of a peacemaker. "But rejoices in the truth, bears all things, believes all things, and hopes all things, endures all things." So this leads, I think, to an understanding of the essential attribute of a peacemaker, and it is to have this loving concern for others, which in turn will cause us to be content. Content with what we have, content in our situation, whatever situation we might be found in. As Paul had written in Philippians 4 and verse 11, he said, "I have learned in whatever state I am in to be content." He said, "I learned. I know how to be abased. I know how to abound. Everywhere and in all things, I've learned to be full, and even when he was hungry, both to abound, to suffer need." And the reason was because he knew that he could endure. He could live through this. That God was working with him. And he was content with this fact. He's saying, "I can do all things. I can get through it. Not on my own, but through Christ who strengthens me." So we need to understand that we can deal with it. God is not going to allow us to suffer anything that is above what we might be able to handle. The problem comes up sometimes is we actually can handle a lot more than we might think, and God allows situations that are sometimes quite stressful and quite distressing. But the contentment that Paul learned to have is that all things will work for good to those who love God, to those individuals who are called according to his purpose. And this gives us the type of the peace of mind that a peacemaker should have. And so if God is working with, if we believe God is working with us, and I think that he is, then we know that he is going to get us through. He is going to give us what we need, not always what we want. I've said that many times. What we need is not, or what we want is not always what we need. And we need to therefore be content with our family, with our possessions, with the Church of God or organization, the brethren that we might attend with on a weekly basis. But this does not mean that one thing that needs to we need to understand this because it could be misunderstood. It doesn't mean that we shouldn't desire to have nicer things. You know, it doesn't mean that we shouldn't desire to seek a better job so that we can create a better life for our family. That we shouldn't want a newer or a more reliable automobile. There's nothing wrong with seeking those things, but if seeking them takes us away from our relations, or detracts, I should say, detracts us from our relationship with God, if it moves us from better obeying his commandments, well, this can be become a problem. It can be a big distraction for us, and you know, take us, remove our vision of what is truly important in life, or I should say God's vision of what is truly important in life. 1 Timothy 6, 1 Timothy this time in chapter 6, there's a difference in wanting to improve our life and being discontented or unhappy with life, because we can seek better things and yet be okay with not getting them if it isn't God's will. And Paul spoke of this, I think, in 1 Timothy 6 and verse 5, when he talks about individuals, useless wranglings, disputing, in other words, with men of corrupt minds and destitute of the truth, who suppose that godliness is a means of gain. You know, some people simply want to get into the church, to be a member of God's church, so that they can profit from it. I remember Michelle was telling me this, what was it? Was that a radio program you listened to, or a television program? You saw where there was the individual was explaining a lot of prophecy in the book of Revelation, and a lot of it was true. In fact, I think taken from the Church of God. But their idea was, how can I profit from this? And so they would offer packages. Here's this package of how can you understand? $59.95, and all you have to do is pay for this. But if you want a better understanding, you can pay $109, and this will get you a better understanding of wow. This is what it has come to, people stealing from God's church and trying to profit from it, a means of gain. And God said, or Paul, I should say, Paul was inspired to say, from such withdraw yourself. And in verse 6, he says, godliness with contentment is great gain. And he goes on to explain, hey, we brought nothing into this world. We came into this world with nothing, just the skin on our bones. And it's certain we are going to carry nothing out. Nothing physically, that is. We will bring our character with us out of this world. And so the point is, if the pleasures of this world were aligned with godliness, well, then we see the pleasures of this world would endure. But the scriptures say that godliness is aligned with contentment, without regard for desires of the flesh. It doesn't matter, as Paul said, no matter what situation I find myself in, I've learned. It's a process of learning, of seeking. I've learned to be content. In verses 9 through 11 of 1 Timothy 6, but those who desire to be rich fall into temptation and a snare, and into many foolish and harmful lusts, which drown men in destruction and perdition. For the love of money is the root of all kinds of evil. for which some have strayed from the faith in their greediness and pierced themselves through with many sorrows. But you, O man of God, flee these things and pursue righteousness, godliness, faith, love, patience, gentleness. Some of the fruits of the Spirit here. So we understand this, but it's hard, I think, sometimes for people to really make it a part of their lives, that life is more than stuff. Life is more than pleasures. It's more than how we feel. Contentment and peace is of more value than diamonds and gold. And this led Christ to say that it's easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to enter the kingdom of God. And it's because the people that are wealthy learn to place a lot of value on their possessions. It means a lot to them. But then they seem to go through life vastly unfulfilled because they're not seeking what's truly important in life. But the structure of our society promotes this kind of dissatisfaction and a need to get more and more in order to be happy. You know, you're not happy unless you drink this drink. You're not going to be happy unless you use this perfume. Things aren't going to work out for you unless you drive this kind of vehicle. This is the opposite, obviously, of contentment. Interestingly, a higher education poll had asked college students, what is essential to them in life? What is the most important thing to you in life, college students today? 81%, the vast majority, said to be rich. That's what they placed most valuable in life. 51% said to be famous. And 30% said to help people who are in need. 22% be leaders in their community. 10% said to become more spiritual. Way down on the list of priorities for most people. So modern society is consumed by self-image and all of the stuff, the pleasures that we can enjoy in life. And this moves people further away from contentment, and I think further away, therefore, from peace, further away from God. The National Association of Home Builders reports that the average American house in 1973 was 1,660 square feet. In 2004, it's 2,400 square feet. And we've seen this. Homes are getting bigger and bigger, it seems, to those who can afford it. According to a recent survey, the owners of one of every 11 homes also rents a self-storage space. The United States possesses about 1.9 billion square feet of personal storage space outside of the home. And so the point is, if you see what I'm getting at, houses get bigger, average family sizes are getting smaller, and yet there's still a need to tack on nearly 2 million square feet of storage space to hold our stuff. The homes aren't big enough anymore. We got to put it in storage. Break it out when we want it, play with it, put it back. And so we see, therefore, where most people's priorities are these days. It's not with family. It's not with God. It's with stuff. And see, it seems like the manner in which people spend money today is what defines people, at least in the eyes of many people in a secular society. So family, though, it wasn't like this, though. When this nation was built, family and the church even, that is, the church as many people understood it, the Bible as many people understood it, God. This was what gave people a sense of identity, a sense of belonging, a sense of meaning in life. But now, well, we have Nike. We got Samsung. We got iPods. We got Facebook. This is what becomes important to many people in life. And this is what most people seem to be seeking. Self-image. Stuff to accumulate more and more, to be recognized, to be wealthy. And with these kind of pursuits in the world, there will be no peace. An anonymous author had said, "Peace is the deliberate adjustment of my life to the will of God." That is how we are going to find peace. That is how we are going to become a peacemaker. Adjusting the will, our own will, our life, to the will of God. Contentment will follow. Humility. and an outgoing concern for others. Knowing that we are living according to the will of God is the only way that peace can be found and the only way that we can be considered a peacemaker. And this doesn't mean that we are going to have a cessation of strife. We are going to have those moments. Sometimes we're going to have to just simply put up with situations that we cannot be resolved at this time. But it doesn't have to define us. It doesn't have to, in other words, affect our mindset. It doesn't have to bring us to a point where we do not have contentment or a peace of mind. We can be content and actually joyful about the direction that we are heading in life, even when we may not have very much, even when times might be rough. Proverbs 17:1 says that better is a dry morsel with quietness than a house full of feasting with strife. And this is talking about constant argument, argument that's really unnecessary. You know, our lives don't have to be like that. We can live peaceably with one another, if at all possible. And it is possible much of the time, because contentment can bring us to a sense of peace. In Psalm 34, this does take effort. It takes effort. We have to seek peace. We have to seek it, and by seeking it means that we have to seek God. In Psalm chapter 34, in verse 14, it says, "Depart from evil and do good, seek peace and pursue it." And then the first right above it says, "Keep your tongue from evil and your lips from speaking deceit. Depart from evil, do good, seek peace and pursue it." It's talking about seeking after God. And again, this was mentioned in the reading today. And King David wrote about this, saying that my heart yearns after you, God, like a thirsty deer pants after a brook. So does my heart seek after you, O God. And so what this relates is that seeking God and seeking to become a peacemaker in this way, this needs to be a priority in our lives. We can't simply think about it and say, oh, wouldn't it be nice to be content? Wouldn't it be nice to be one of those people that seems that things don't seem to bother them, that just kind of let it roll off their back? Well, why can't we work at being like that? It's not that we are not concerned, because some people confuse that. Some people confuse contentment within the mind of an individual as being unconcerned. No, that's not it at all. But we don't let it bring us down, become disheartened, in other words. Proverbs 26, we need to make real efforts to be at peace in order to be considered a peacemaker. And there is a time in this for strong words, and when I say strong words, I don't mean curse words. I don't think there's ever a time for that. But there is a time for words that can be hard for some people to hear. It might prick their conscience, and hopefully in the right way, and the words are expressed as a concern for them because of our loving concern for them. And I think this was even expressed by God through the prophet Isaiah in chapter 51 of verse 1, where he said to cry aloud, to spare not, to lift up their voice like a trumpet and tell my people their sins. It was to prick them, to move them to a state of repentance so that they would change. And this was because of God's loving concern for them, not because he wanted to hurt them, but sometimes the truth hurts. And also in Proverbs 26 and in verse 5, it says, "To answer a fool according to his folly, lest he be wise in his own eyes." So what's it saying is we have to respond sometimes. We can't let them just go along believing, well, that's the truth. Sometimes we need to respond, but we have to do it in a respectful way. Because the verse before, right above this, in verse 4, it says, "Do not answer a fool according to his folly, lest you also be like him." So we have to be respectful in the way, not the way some people might talk to us, but be the better person and speak to them differently in a way that they might not expect. And you could actually win them over in this way, because a kind word turns away wrath. And it's talking about, hey, well, they might be railing on you, but how about turning up and saying, well, you know, I know you feel bad about this, but here, can we talk calmly? And express that in a way that they're going to receive and not be, you know, like, oh, I know better than you do, so you better listen to me. Because immediately, I've seen it happen this week in that dispute at the garden. Immediately it's rejected. One person was talking above the other, like, yeah, I know better than you, and you should listen to me. And that's not going to be well received, even if it might be the case at times. So sometimes we have to respond even when the argument's foolish, but we have to not allow our feelings to choose our words. And too many times I've seen people speak this way, as the lady this week, about how they feel instead of what was actually said or what actually needs to be said. And then we miss out on an opportunity to help the situation, and we actually will do more harm than good. Proverbs 15 in verse 1 and 2. I guess I had quoted this already. A soft answer turns away wrath, but a harsh word stirs up anger. And the tongue of the wise uses knowledge rightly, but the mouth of fools pours forth foolishness. So if we don't lean to our own understanding, and if we respond in a way that is based upon trying to be helpful, not based on emotion, but it's based on the truth. You know, we don't have to candy coat it, but, you know, say it in a way that's reasonable. If we just state the facts, you know, we can end an argument before the contention even begins at times. And this is attributed to being a peacemaker. Matthew in chapter 7, even so, we are going to face people that are not seeking peace in this life. They're not going to listen to the truth. They will not listen to words of reason. But from such people, sometimes the best thing to do is just shut our mouth, turn away. Christ said this in Matthew 7 and verse 6, and I guess I'd paraphrase this already. He says, "Do not give what is holy to the dogs, or cast your pearls before swine, lest they trample them under their feet and turn and tear you in pieces." So it's not worth the frustration. It's not, you know, it's going to be a losing battle sometimes to try to convince someone who might deny God's authority, to try to convince them that the Bible is valid and they need to change their ways. Many of them might simply be trying to pick a fight. They want you to respond in a way that's going to join in the argument, to heat up the argument. And so a soft answer can turn away hostility, and sometimes a bit of truth can simmer this down, but sometimes this just might make them angry. And we just have to turn away. It's not worth it. Revelation 19. I know I'm kind of making a lot of points in one message. These could be several messages, actually, but anyway... Because many Christians refuse to engage in foolish disputes, or because, you know, violence is not something that we would advocate, one mistake many make is to equate peace to pacifism. But Jesus was not a pacifist. Aristotle had said, "We make war so that we may have peace." And this is not entirely true when humanly speaking, but there is a truth to that statement when it comes to God. In order to be a peacemaker, you and I spiritually have to war against the flesh. We are in a battle with Satan, with tainted human nature, and as Paul put it, we are to be a good soldier of Jesus Christ. And this is, of course, metaphorically speaking. But with this in mind, the book of Revelation indicates that God is eventually going to make war in order to bring worldwide peace. Revelation 19 and verse 11, John saw heaven opened, and behold, a white horse, and he who sat on him was called Faithful and True, and in righteousness he judges and makes war. His eyes were like a flame of fire. On his head were many crowns, the King of Kings. And he had a name written that no one knew except himself. He was clothed with a robe dipped in blood, and his name is called the Word of God. And the armies in heaven, clothed in fine linen, white and clean, followed him on white horses. And out of his mouth goes a sharp sword, that with it he should strike the nations. And he himself will rule them with a rod of iron. He himself treads the winepress of the fierceness of the wrath of Almighty God. And he has on his robe and on his thigh a name written, King of Kings and Lord of Lords. And then we see in Joel in chapter 3, how the armies, or angelic armies of heaven, come through and clean house, making war against the wicked people of the earth. And so sometimes war is necessary, but keep in mind, though, keep this in mind. God did not pick this fight. He didn't start it, but he's going to finish it. It's the spiritual wickedness of this world found in the prince of the power of the air, the devil and his angels, and it is the tainted human nature that chose to fight with God, to contend with God. And so he's going to set things straight. And you and I, our job as a good soldier is to choose a side. Whose side you're going to be on. And I think I know what we have chosen. That's why we're here today. And this leads us to the understanding that there can be no peace without God. Isaiah in chapter 59. We're almost done here. Isaiah 59. Some people like to criticize the Bible and they try to promote their own idea of what peace is. And in most cases, especially we see among the liberal community today, in most cases, their idea of peace is simply tolerance of evil, of allowing all kinds of wickedness to take place. But peace in this way is not really peace. And it's not going to last if God is not a part of the peacemaking process. And so Isaiah 59 and verses 1 through 8, it says, Behold, the Eternal's hand is not shortened that it cannot save, nor his ear heavy that it cannot hear. But your iniquities, your rebellion, your lawless behavior have separated you from your God, and your sins has hidden his face from you so that he will not hear. For your hands are defiled with blood, your fingers with iniquity, your lips have spoken lies, your tongue has muttered perversity. No one calls for justice, nor does any plead for truth. They trust in empty words, and they speak lies. They conceive evil and bring forth iniquity. They hatch vipers' eggs and weave the spider's web. And he who eats of their eggs dies, and from that which is crushed, a viper breaks out. Sounds like a description of our society today, doesn't it? Their webs will not become garments, nor will they cover themselves from their works. Their works are out of iniquity, and the act of violence is in their hands. Their feet run to do evil, and they make haste to shed innocent blood to hurt others. Their thoughts are thoughts of iniquity. Wasting and destruction are in their paths, and the way of peace they have not known. And therefore there is no justice in their ways, and they have made for themselves crooked paths, and whoever takes that way shall not know peace. Now this is a snapshot of Israel before their fall, but it closer resembles much of America and the world today. In fact, one could argue, and maybe you want to read this later, Romans chapter 3 and verses 10 through 17, read that. Paul paraphrasing some of these scriptures, some of them quoting directly, but it sounds like an accurate description of much of what is taking place in the liberal media today and in the government. Now, mankind cannot have enduring peace or even a real definition of peace without God. It's not possible. As evil grows, as the love of many continues to fade, God and lasting peace we see is being driven further away from us. But there is a way of peace that is explained in the scriptures, and you and I are trying to become peacemakers, according to the definition of the Bible. And a final scripture in chapter 32 of Isaiah, just a few pages back, chapter 32. You and I can sigh and cry about the sins, about the heartache, about the hurt that is caused by those people of the world that reject God. And we can step in when the opportunity arises to point out the transgression, but you know, we're not always going to win the argument, at least in the eyes of people that we might be contending with. So I suggest we pick our fights wisely, and and don't lose heart if we are hurt in some of these situations, but instead be humble, be content with whatever situation we are found in, with whatever we are allowed to possess. It's all God's anyway. And we can have discussions without a heated argument, and we can contend for the truth continually, having a loving concern for other individuals, and seek God at this time. Seek the will of God, knowing that a time is coming, in Isaiah 32 and verse 16, that justice will dwell in the wilderness and righteousness will remain in the fruitful field. And the work of righteousness will be peace. And the effect of righteousness, quietness and assurance or stability forever. Blessed are the peacemakers.